Welcome, everybody, to today's B-Side. I'm your host, as always, Adam Proctor. And joining me on the program today is my long-lost co-host. It's been a while. Amy Therese, how you doing?
Hi, sweeties. How are we? I'm well.
Are you feeling rested after your long hiatus? You had a lot going on. Summertime for you. You're in summer break, and you are enjoying the weather while the rest of us are pretty miserable. So everybody direct your ire at Amy Therese for the next 3 months.
I am tanned, rested, and ready.
Tanned, rested, and ready. Glad to hear it. And joining us for today's B-side is a man, a voice, a brain that many of you will all be quite familiar with. He's been on the show before, and his writings are quite prolific. Benjamin Studebaker, thanks for coming back on the show.
I'm so glad to be back, Adam, and it's good to talk to Amy again, too.
Yeah. So we've got the A-team assembled, even though it's a B-side. I think we're going to knock this one out of the park. Everybody sit down. We're ready to break down some topics. We got a lot to talk about because Ben, you've been writing, it seems like one blog piece on the hour, every hour for the past 3 months. And which fortunately for us gives us much to say. What's your secret to this level of output? How do you produce? Like, was one day you wrote three blog pieces in one day in the lead up to Christmas? Is that right?
Yeah, I just find it relaxing to me to write blog posts because, unlike the rest of my work, which is being submitted to someone who will have all sorts of criticisms for it, I can immediately publish my blog posts as long as I'm satisfied with them. I'm my only critic. So it's very relaxing for me to write them, and I don't worry too much about how they're received.
This might be a little pedantic. You're not your only critic. You're your only editor. Every single person on left Twitter is a critic these days. So.
That's true. That's true. Good point.
And your first piece that we're going to start talking about today is one that you wrote a few months ago, but it's been made incredibly relevant with Elizabeth Warren's announcement that she will indeed be the first official candidate for the 2020 Democratic Party primary. Let's talk a little bit about that one. I think, you know, the left has been overwhelmed with criticisms of Beto O'Rourke for the past month. But it's time to reignite our passion as Democratic Socialists against Liz Warren, I think, which is something that's very controversial. I think many people who are perhaps listening to the show right now will be far more amenable to the idea of a Liz Warren candidacy than we are right now. So let's make a really strong case here. Let's take this seriously. What was your thought process in writing that particular piece about Liz Warren?
Well, I think there was a time, perhaps as recently as 2014, where she was widely considered the most left-wing major person that could potentially be the Democratic nominee. I think that Bernie Sanders shattered that. He, in part, was able to shatter that by running, and he was enabled to run by Elizabeth Warren's decision not to run. Well, why didn't Elizabeth Warren decide to run when she was the most competitive person to represent the left faction? Well, Elizabeth Warren isn't really interested in taking over the party on behalf of the left, and has never really been interested in that. Elizabeth Warren was a Reaganite until the 90s, and is mainly content with the major shifts away from 70s capitalism that we've seen. What she is really interested in doing is helping to sell the Democratic Party to people on the left as more left-wing than it is. What she's interested in doing is securing a cabinet position in a centrist Democrats administration from which she can fulfill her real dream of being a public policy wonk. That's what she really wants to do. And at this point, her favorability rating is -8. Her net rating is -8. It's very clear that she can't be president. So why is she running? And in particular, why is she announcing 4 months earlier than Ted Cruz announced in 2015. Well, the reason for that is that she's trying to pull resources and support away from Bernie Sanders by preempting him. She has no intention of winning the nomination. She wants to take 3 or 5 percentage points away from Bernie Sanders and cause those votes to be wasted to increase the chance that a centrist wins the nomination and then thanks her with a cabinet position.
I think critics will jump in at this point and say that's highly speculative. What leads you to believe in the most concrete of senses that this is indeed her motivation? How has she acted in the past that might lend toward that interpretation?
Well, she declined to run when she was the person who could be this person. Now her numbers are much worse. Her support base is much worse. She has a much weaker chance of becoming president now than she did 4 years ago. So why didn't she run then and why is she running now? Secondly, when she had an opportunity in Massachusetts to endorse Bernie Sanders and join Merkley in doing so, she declined to do that. Why did she decline to endorse Bernie Sanders in the primary? Well, she wanted to keep her options open so that she could make alliances with the center of the party. And thirdly, what has she spent the last 2 years doing discursively? She has continually positioned herself to the right of Sanders. She has continually said, I'm not a socialist. I'm not for democratic socialism. I'm for moderated capitalism or well-regulated capitalism. That is a deliberate decision to position herself to the right of the Bernie movement as a compromise candidate between the Bernie movement and the what's left of the Clinton movement. She has also proposed a number of different policy reforms that are too small in scope to tackle this moment politically. And it's because she doesn't have a grand vision for how to remake the Democratic Party or for how to realign or remake American politics more broadly. She's mainly interested in a relatively narrow set of policy reforms. This is not a bold enough vision for this time period, and it's not the kind of vision that a presidential candidate ought to have. It's the kind of vision you would have if you were getting ready to run a department in someone else's administration.
Yeah, the other material factor that I think bears mentioning is, Adam, although you said she's announced a primary candidacy, at the risk of sounding pedantic, technically, what she's actually said is, I'm launching an exploratory committee looking at a primary candidacy, which is she's staking out a particular patch of turf for herself, but in an entirely non-committal way, which in much the same way as she chose not to endorse Bernie, but eventually endorsed Hillary when the stakes were much lower, right? She's hedging her bets. And, you know, in combination with everything we understand about her politics and what she believes, I think what that tells us is that politically, she is not the type of leader that we need right now. We need a leader who is unwaveringly committed to not just enforcing the rules of the existing game, but actually redrawing like the rules and the bounds of play. Because simply enforcing the status quo, sort of hedging your bets and attempting to like just move the pieces around on the board is not enough. And I think if we look, not, you know, I don't think we need to speculate about Warren's inner state to be fully on board with what Benjamin is saying about what she's actually doing and what she's actually done up to now. Does that make sense? Like, I actually think there are very concrete things that she has done and is doing that support that without needing to attribute motive to her. You know what I mean?
Right, right. I think, you know, one of the things that we can look at is this kind of dissonance or distance, for sure, between the positions that she staked out throughout her entire political career and the radical nature of some of the proposals that she's put out in this, quote, exploratory committee agenda. What are some of the key policy issues that she wants to take up? Because they seem to have excited certain fractions of the left with their seeming radicality, you might say. I would say it's a faux radicalism. But of course, we want to make that case. We don't just want to sort of state it and not show it. What are some of those policies, Benjamin?
Well, one of the things that I find very curious about her is that for a very long time, she wasn't for Medicare for All. Then she says that she's for it. But then she's at the same time releasing policy white papers on healthcare that fall short of Medicare for All. And so she goes back and forth between saying, oh, yes, I'm for these very radical reforms, but also here's my policy white paper for something that's much less radical than this. And that to me says that there isn't really an intention there. You're looking at someone who wasn't for Medicare for All until Bernie Sanders came out for it and has continually produced white papers for other kinds of healthcare policy that's much less radical. And so I find it very difficult to believe that claim.
Well, it performs a certain signaling function to, as you suggested, a contingent of the party. She's saying, I can at least tick some of the boxes that Bernie is ticking in terms of his appeal, but I'm safe. I'm a much safer.
You can trust me not to follow through with any of that.
I'm not committed. I'm fundamentally not committed.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, one of the things that should concern all of us, and you know, we sort of walk this fine line between progressive politics and democratic socialist politics on this podcast quite a bit. Not because we're milquetoast, wishy-washy sock Dems, but because the progressives have definitely gained an upper hand in the real goings on of the American political scene. Particularly since the midterm elections, and it's a force that needs to be reckoned with, even as people who are much further to the left in terms of our aspirations and our policies. And it certainly is the case that most progressives want a kinder, gentler form of capitalism, which is something we're perennially critical of as socialists. But Liz Warren has gone even further than most quote progressive candidates are willing to go in her affinity for capitalism, going so far as saying that she is, quote, capitalist to her bones. What do you make of Warren's love affair with capitalism and her belief that somehow we can come up with a kinder, gentler form of capitalism that has fairness and rules-based procedures built into it? What do you make of that, Benjamin?
Well, she's a kind of worried Reaganite, because what she's calling for isn't a return to 60s, 70s New Deal, Great Society stuff. It falls short of that because she's someone who thought that the Reagan Revolution was necessary and would still defend it as having been necessary. So what she wants is something that is in between the Reagan, neoliberal order that we now have, and the post-war order. So she's not even someone who's saying, let's revive the Democratic Party of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. She's saying, let's modestly tweak where we're at so that we're somewhere in between that and where we now are. So we're talking about not democratic socialism, not post-war Keynesianism, but something which is sort of left of where the party now is, but not very far. And at the same time, whenever she's been pushed to make a stand for a left faction in the party against the center faction, she backs off. So it makes me very skeptical even that she supports this much change.
Right. So let's spell that out in as much detail as we possibly can. When you say that Warren was broadly in favor, whether implicitly or explicitly, of the Reagan Revolution, the Reagan reforms, and that she herself is not an advocate or proponent of 1950s, 60s style post-war New Deal liberalism. What do you mean? Spell those two distinctions out for us, if you don't mind.
I mean, she was a registered Republican until the 90s, quite explicitly so. And what I mean is that in the 50s and 60s, there were efforts to build economic rights for different groups of people. When Bernie Sanders talks about how we need these economic rights, this second Bill of Rights that FDR talked about in the 40s. He's talking about the kind of political dream of the Keynesians, which had a lot of overlap with social democracy and democratic and the version of democratic socialism, which was extant in Western Europe at that time. It was efforts to gradually expand the set of economic rights that people had, to include things like education, healthcare, an income, a job. What we're talking about with Elizabeth Warren is tougher regulations, but not the expansion of rights.
If I could, I know this sounds like a very reductionist metaphor, but I think it holds. she feels as if there are some people playing unfairly, and she wants the cheaters out of the game.
Right.
But the premise of that, like the smuggled in premise, is that the game itself is fair when the umpire is fair. When the umpire calls balls and strikes and there are less cheaters on the field, people have the opportunity to work hard and the meritocracy will reward them as long as the bad people, the bad players, are off the field and the umpires are fair.
And this is something she has in common with the libertarians, because the libertarians say, well, capitalism doesn't work right because the state overregulates it and gets in the way of it playing fair. Well, she has broadly the same position, except she thinks the state needs to regulate it a little bit more.
Yeah,
but both her and the libertarians agree that the system is broadly fair.
Right. So she was quoted in her video when she announced her exploratory committee to enter the primary race. She says, quote, "America's middle class is under attack." Note, she said middle class, not working class, or oftentimes what people will say, such as Bernie Sanders, for example, the middle class and the working class, or middle class and workers, or whatever, what have you.
Or poor and working people.
The poor and working people.
Yeah.
She went on to say, America's middle class is under attack. That's a bit of managerial capitalist kind of jargon there.
It's Blairite language.
Blairite language, third way kind of approach. And she goes on to say, how did we get here? Billionaires and big corporations decided they wanted more of the pie, and they enlisted politicians to cut them a bigger slice. So this sounds, in rhetoric, very similar to the way that Bernie Sanders rails on about the millionaires and the billionaires, you know, every chance that he can get. And then on the other, you know, the other hand, she will immediately then turn to this love for capitalism. She said later in that speech that she's capitalist to her bones. So what do we make of this kind of rhetorical strategy when she's sort of calling out the billionaires and the big corporations, trying to produce a much more level and fair playing field? It sounds a lot like Bernie Sanders, doesn't it?
Well, there's an effort to collapse the distinction between the two to get people who are left-wing and who are frustrated to see her as part of their wing of the party and consider her as a possible younger viable alternative to Sanders. And there are a number of different people who are going to run in the primaries with this kind of strategy. They want you to think of them as part of the same project. The main difference is that Bernie Sanders recognizes that the system is presently constructed, the political system and the economic system, are running us into a couple of big crisis-level problems, a legitimacy crisis in the political system, and climate change, and environmental and economic crisis that is emerging over the century. And to deal with these crises, we need to make profound changes to our political system and our economic system. And that means that not only do radical policies need to be enacted and implemented, but the Republican Party needs to be dragged to the center or even to the left by a Democratic Party, which is completely transformed and unrecognizable from the point of view of the 80s and the 90s and the aughts. And that is a very, very radical vision, and it requires tremendous leadership. It requires tremendous organization. It requires fighting inside the Democratic Party to change it, and then fighting in Congress and in the state houses to force the Republican Party to accept and integrate into its own platform a lot of different things. And this is something that may sound impossible, but of course it was done in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and 60s. The Democrats went to the left, dragged the Republican Party to the left, made people like Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon into people who would support the expansion of the federal state in all kinds of different areas. Nixon created the Environmental Protection Agency, for pity's sake. So that kind of realignment is not even part of Elizabeth Warren's aspirations, much less part of her capacity to produce. And it may be that it's not possible to produce, but Bernie Sanders is at least interested in producing it and willing to try. We may find out it's impossible. We may find out we're all screwed and none of it matters. But Bernie Sanders is willing to try and Elizabeth Warren is not. And that is the key difference, no matter what language she uses to obscure it.
I wholeheartedly agree. Sorry, I didn't mean to jump in so quickly. But I think launching from what Benjamin said, this, to me, like, I hear it semi, not a dog whistle, but like, there's very much a tell in that language. And I don't want to like read too much into it, but given her history, I actually think it's relevant. She says that the, you know, corporations and billionaires and whomever decided they wanted more of the pie. And the middle class is under attack. Companies are amoral. They don't decide they want more of anything. They're just doing what they are instituted to do. That's number one. There's no, like, subjective, like, you know, there's a set of historical conditions that have put us in the situation we're in. It's not a matter of, like, personal things or, well, anyway, so there's that. But there's also this idea of the middle class being under attack, as though that is when it becomes relevant. Because let's remember, for the last, you know, up until the mid-90s, when things were only awful for the bottom 60 or 70% of people, as opposed to the bottom 80 or 90% of people, she was a Republican. And so Bernie's assessment of present conditions is such that we need radical policies to deal with crisis level events like climate change or like, you know, inequality that is rampant, worse than the Gilded Age. Like, but the point is that back when Elizabeth Warren was a Republican, and back when the people under, quote, under attack were just the bog standard working class of people who are under perpetual attack in a capitalist system, Elizabeth Warren was totally fucking fine with it. It is only once it becomes threatening to, quote, the middle class, it's only once millionaires and billionaires and corporations decided they wanted a little bit too much. They made it they were just a little bit too impolite. It was a little unseemly at this point. But the fundamental premise of, you know, 50, 60% of the population living paycheck to paycheck, which will always be the case under capitalism, that's no problem for her.
She's concerned about the chunk of people who have a college degree but aren't able to get what they wanted out of that college.
She's concerned about the
middle managers.
The seams of the meritocracy, right? The facade is cracking. And that's what she's concerned with, right?
Like, right, it's about shoring up the meritocracy. It's not about fundamental change.
And this is why I say she's a hole monitor. This is why I say she's a hole monitor. That's absolutely.
Yeah. So I think one of my main concerns, and I want to talk about a little bit about this, is that she does have a couple of policies that on their face seem pretty radical. And I want to talk about these because it's gotten quite a bit of both agreement and disagreement whenever I've brought these up in the public sphere, which i.e. social media. And that particular policy is what is being called the Accountable Capitalism Act. And that, you know, just we could probably stop there, right? I mean, any committed socialist, particularly Marxist, hears a policy named the Accountable Capitalism Act. I mean, I think immediately the hairs should stand up on the back of your neck and your gag reflex should kick up. But in case it doesn't, in case you're not there yet, in case you need to be walked a little further down the line towards principled democratic socialism, let's talk a little bit about this Accountable Capitalism Act, because it's here and where she's proposing a thing called co-determination. And it's modeled after policies from places like Germany in the early days of social democracy. And it looks like her particular proposal will only apply to firms worth more than $1 billion. So very, very large corporate firms with big corporate boards. And the bill, if it is implemented, which we'll talk about the barriers to that in just a moment, such a bill would require corporate expenditures on political candidates to be approved by shareholders. It would also eliminate incentives that Warren says encourage executives to pay dividends and buy back their shares of stock rather than plowing their investments back into corporate back to the productive sector, so to speak, so which would produce more jobs and those things of that nature. It would give workers of firms shares and ownership and thus co-determination of the decisions that the firm makes. And so this is one step along the way, Warren's proponents say, towards something that looks like workplace democracy. So let's talk a little bit about this proposal, because I think we want to attack this from a number of angles. What do you make, Ben, of this Accountable Capitalism Act?
Well, I mean, it might be better than absolutely nothing, but it is completely lacking in aspiration, and it doesn't meet the challenges of the time. We're at a time where there needs to be major cooperation among states to deal with international tax avoidance, where there needs to be major cooperation among states to deal with an impending climate crisis. And you're talking about minor kinds of little tiny reforms that give workers maybe marginally more power, but not in any kind of significant way, and only apply to particular kinds of firms, and just don't address the fundamental legitimation problem that we have. We have people who are so alienated and so miserable in our society that they're prepared to vote for Donald Trump, that they're prepared to vote for someone whose campaign is, I will smash the people who have been around for 30 years, and I'll break all the shit that they made. That's how people are feeling, and our response to that is a kind of minor policy wonk thing that only addresses a small number of firms and a small number of workers and only gives them marginally more power and doesn't in any way guarantee them higher wages or health care or education. It's just way, way too small. And we have seen the cost over the last 20 or 30 years of voting for Democrats who are not committed to doing big things. And the cost is that everybody gets disappointed in the Democrat. And then 8 years later, you get a Republican who's more conservative, more right-wing, more nationalist than the previous one.
Right. I think one of the things that we also want to discuss, you know, taking all that on board, is I think we're making a big assumption here and assuming that we would have the amount of political and class struggle necessary to wrest control away from these immensely powerful corporate entities, right? I think like Liz Warren's sort of downfall, which is what Amy, you pointed to very succinctly, her primary downfall, I mean, even when she's at her best and she's railing against the corporate, you know, the corporations and the billionaires and all the rest of it, she seems to be motivated by this belief that you can merely, I don't know, wag your finger enough, or you can use the power of an allegedly neutral state. Right. This is kind of like very if Ben, just to push back a little bit, if she does have any kind of 1950s and 60s liberalism in her, it's this wrongheaded belief that the state is this neutral playing field wherein, you know, special interests and political, you know, entities kind of vie for power and sort of bully the corporate, you know, the corporations and the economic sector. Where they have those types of folks at their mercy. And that's just clearly not the case. I mean, we push state theory very, very heavily here on DPS, and that's for a reason, because the state is not a neutral field of struggle. Vivek Chhibber and I discussed that on this week's A-Side. Everybody should buy that pamphlet from Catalyst to read more about socialism, capitalism, and the state. But what kind of class struggle will be necessary, Amy? You seem to have some thoughts on that.
Well, I guess the thing that I find, sorry, let me reframe. So there's two things going on that I think. The first thing is, as socialists, I think it's a really wonderful thing that some of our ideas and prescriptions are gaining traction, certainly like amongst broader swaths of the general public. That's a wonderful thing. But, like, simultaneously, we need to not forget and, like, shout out to a friend of the show, FentPop, on Twitter, who said just really simply recently, we need to not tail a liberal analysis because ours has more explanatory power. And I think what's happening is that because some of the terminology that both Marxists or socialists use and kind of left-leaning progressive liberals use, because they have these terms that are the same terms, we sort of get confused and think we're talking about the same thing. And quite frequently, we are not. So when liberals use a term like class, quite frequently what they mean is some kind of amorphous, like, so they'll use the term social class, which doesn't always translate to anything concrete. And it certainly doesn't sit within any kind of coherent structural analysis, and certainly not one of historical materialism. Which is where I get to my second point, which is the idea of history or historicity. Anyway, my point being that Liz Warren is both kind of cribbing from leftist terminology, but actually deploying it in a fundamentally atomized liberal fashion. And then secondly, she has no concept of everything she's saying is ahistorical. She has no concept of class power. No, and certainly she's not a historical materialist. The idea that class forces and the balance therein are what change history and shape things is one that's fundamentally completely fucking absent from her analysis. Not just absent, but like that's not actually how she understands the world to work. So when she talks about these ideas of instituting certain types of reform, we, I think, as democratic socialists or Marxists or whatever, it's very tempting to conflate Bernie and Elizabeth Warren, because as democratic socialists, there are certain types of reforms or non-reformist reforms, or even just certain types of reforms that would be incredibly beneficial to our broader long-term project. But I think what happens is with this conceptual slipperiness between like the language, we sort of forget that even though on the surface her ideas might sound kind of radical, when they're not actually positioned within any kind of coherent framework, any kind of understanding of the balance of class forces as being the fundamental engine of history, they're just sort of swaying in the wind. And I think certainly things like the idea that as just like an individual top-down regulator, you can just, you know, sort of tinker with the rules and then institute the right people to enforce them, is completely fucking ahistorical, and it is not going to work.
Yeah,
and
it's that's just not
even
going to work.
If
yeah,
and that's right. Even if she's as even if she's committed to the maximalist version of whatever she's saying, and we covered earlier the idea that I suspect she's not right. I think there's a lot of she's hedging her bets in myriad ways, but like let's grant the maximalist version of everything she's saying. We don't believe that that is actually how history is advanced. We don't, even if she institutes this fully like great version of regulation, top-down regulation, that's not how capitalism works.
Well, in the 70s, the point at which it all started to go the other way was the point at which the system was most equal and in which the rules were strongest.
Yes, exactly, because the rate of... Exactly, and this is what I'm saying, where her analysis has no... what the terms she's using may sound like they're of part of a left analysis, but they're not. They're these atomized, weird, liberal, like, simulacra of our terminology, and they're not fitting into a broader, actual, coherent notion. And she has no concept of history and understanding. She thinks that a top-down fix, having the right umpire and the right rules, will make things better. And,
yeah,
and
so let's make the case as to why that's not the case, why that's not true. Because I think a lot of people might say, well, sure, you know, maybe she's a little, you know, weak in this or that. I mean, I think, I mean, let's meet our critics where they stand. I don't think many people, not on the left anyway, not even progressives, would argue even that she is the most left-wing candidate. I mean, we saw, we don't have to go in depth here, but a commentator on Twitter who will not be named you know, openly admitted that Bernie Sanders was easily the Democratic candidate, whereas Liz Warren was the progressive candidate. But that Liz Warren espoused a certain multiracial progressivism, whereas Bernie Sanders had a certain like race-blind economism or something. And so therefore, the only principled left-wing candidate was Liz Warren. So there we have an acknowledgement that, well, Warren isn't even the most left-wing candidate, and yet we should still support her nonetheless. So I think a lot of people would say,
where if we heard that before?
Right, shocker. But it seems to be a theme. But a lot of people would push back and say, well, yes, I agree with you. She isn't the most principled left-wing candidate, but we should support her nonetheless for this reason. So talk to me a little bit, Ben, where you mentioned at the outset that she was okay with the Reagan reforms, the Reagan revolution, and that she just doesn't really have much to say about the era of liberalism, as limited as it was at times in the 1970s, as we have covered quite extensively on our show, and I want to continue covering this. The 1970s is vastly overlooked for the level of radicalism. And I'm not talking about this kind of bullshit, stultified, white working class, hard hat, pro-Vietnam, proto-Reagan trade unionist. I'm talking about a multiracial, militant, socialist trade union class war that took place in the 1970s. And if people don't know about it, it's not because it didn't happen. It's because they're fucking ignorant. So pick up a book. In any case, talk to us about that, Benjamin.
Not that we should be telling people to educate themselves. But let me help you out.
I'm not here to educate you.
But
that's emotional labor, Benjamin.
Yeah. But the 70s, of course.
My Venmo is adam.proctor. Anyway.
But yeah, the 70s were a time, really the last major period of legitimation crisis where people did not feel that the system, both politically and economically, was working properly. And so there were critiques of that kind of post-war Keynesian consensus, both from the left and from the right, and a quite serious political struggle to determine whether that system would survive that period of crisis or whether it would change in either a left or a right direction. And there was a quite meaningful left, discrete, separate from post-war Keynesianism, that was pulling on that system from a leftward direction. But it was completely defeated by the Reaganite turn. It was unable to get any traction in the Democratic Party, in part because of changes within the structure of the Democratic Party, which made it easier for more right-wing elements to prevail.
So let's talk a little bit about I'd love to just talk about this for the rest of the night. Unfortunately, we have a lot of topics to get to, and I think we can continue talking about the lack of viability of a Warren candidacy, the fact that she doesn't have the means or the capacities at her disposal to wage the kind of class struggle that would be necessary to disempower, at the least, to disempower these massive corporations and regulate them. And at the most, you would end up taking away control over their own operations by giving shares to their workers in this co-determination scheme. Needless to say, that would require a massive inside-outside coordinated class struggle movement that Warren herself, if she gives lip service to it in various, on various stump speeches where it seems politically advantageous, she certainly hasn't demonstrated the desire or the capacity to build something like that in the past couple of years, much less her entire life. Contrast that with Bernie Sanders, who's been on the stump and walking picket lines and all the rest of it.
No, she was at Harvard claiming to be Native American.
That's right. So let's continue this. But a lot of people will push back even further and say, well, what's the harm in a Liz Warren candidacy? What's the harm in a Liz Warren presidency? Surely that would be a boon To the left. And this gets into the blog piece that you wrote that was quite controversial in some sectors, wherein you argued that a Beto presidency would be worse than a second term for Trump. And I think we can make this argument in a lot of different angles. I think because we can make a principled case to say the same thing about Liz Warren in terms of the left project. And then we can say the same thing about Beto in terms of just the viability of liberalism against the rise of the far right. So let's talk, let's first begin with the case against Warren. Why is it not the case that a Liz Warren presidency would be a net benefit to the left?
Well, the changes that were made in the 80s, changes which Elizabeth Warren supported, changes which she has no intention of reversing, have made our political system and our economic system fundamentally more unstable and prone to periods of crisis. That's what I would start with. If you'll agree with me on that, then you'll agree with me that Elizabeth Warren isn't going to eliminate the tendency for there to be crises. And you'll also agree with me that if you look, the incidence of these major economic shocks since the Reagan era has gotten higher. And we've now had about 10 years since the last. So the question you have to ask yourself is, can Elizabeth Warren go, are we going to have no major recessions or crises in the next 6 to 8 years? And I think the answer is probably not. And so what is likely to happen is that Elizabeth Warren won't do enough to stabilize our system, will sustain a major economic recession at some point in her presidency, and that she and the left will be blamed for that recession and for that instability, and that it will fuel a shift in American politics toward the right, with the Republican Party becoming more conservative than it presently is, with the election of a president in 4 or 8 years, in say 2024 or 2028, who would be much more conservative than Donald Trump. And if that's difficult for you to imagine, I think what you have to think of is maybe someone like Ted Cruz, who almost won this last time, and who is a real believer in a lot of the right-wing economic stuff that Donald Trump just pays lip service to and pretends to care about. We're looking at a Democrat, and this is what has happened. If you look over the last 30 or 40 years, we run centrist Democrats. They don't make major reforms to the economy. We go through periods of recession. We respond to those periods of recession by moving to the right and by making the system more unequal and more prone to crisis. And that we could do another round of that. And if we do another round of that, then we're going to pay the price with a Republican president who reflects that continued rightward shift in the discourse.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, what do you mean when you argue that we're likely to see some economic instability with a Warren presidency, particularly if she's able to implement some of her policies? There's a lot of historical context here that I want to spell out for people. I've talked quite a lot about the instability in the 1970s, the wage squeeze, the recessions of the late 70s, and I think Leo Panitch has been on the show to argue this at multiple intervals. Mike Beggs came on to talk about this. Mike McCarthy came on to talk about this. So there's an extensive history here. I've given some of you all a lot of listening homework if you haven't heard those episodes. But we talked a lot about how the wage squeeze and the global economic reorganization kind of put the left in a bind wherein they really needed to go all the way. They really needed to not have these sort of half measures. They really needed to take ownership and control over the means of production and the kind of political and economic organization of the United States, or else these kind of half measures, say capital controls, some of these other kind of protectionist mechanisms that were in place from post-war liberalism were bound to fail in the face of this kind of neoliberal juggernaut. And so, is that kind of what you mean when you say that? I know I'm sort of this is a leading question. Let me answer the question for you before I ask it. But is that kind of what you're getting at?
I would put it this way: we had quite prosperous working class relative to the historical periods, both before and after in the post-war era. That was grounded on protecting that working class from labor competition from people living in poorer countries. The protections from that competition gradually were worn down. They were deliberately worn down throughout the 50s, 60s, and 70s. by the rich and by corporations. The result of wearing that down is that those workers were subjected to more and more wage competition from people in poorer states. And this created a situation where for those industries to remain competitive, there would need to be major cuts to wages, or there would need to be some kind of renewed protection and or larger shift to the left, further left. And what was decided was to further open trade and subject wages, taxes, and regulations to a global race to the bottom. And that's what the last 40 or 50 years have largely been, a global race to the bottom on all these fronts. The long-term result of that is that there's an imbalance in our economy between consumption and investment, with the consumption sector constantly being squeezed by stagnating wages, and the investment sector constantly expanding as more and more of the output of the economy accrues to people near the top. The result of that is that those people are continually struggling to find profitable places to invest their surplus money because they are unable or unwilling to give that money to ordinary workers and ordinary people. And so they are using it to create bubbles. And sometimes they involve workers in those bubbles by lending that money to workers in quantities that those workers can never hope to repay, and then blaming those workers when they default. And that's mm-hmm. what we saw in the housing crisis. We saw a bunch of people, subprime borrowers, being given loans by rich people, money that they should have earned in higher wages over the preceding decades, but were instead offered in the form of mortgages, and then being unable to repay those mortgages because their wages didn't go up. It's fundamentally unsustainable, and there hasn't been any major shift since 2008 to correct this fundamental imbalance. Indeed, by many metrics, the imbalance has gotten worse. So it's only a matter of time before these bubbles again involve workers and again produce some kind of default scenario.
Right. And at the point at which we have a serious economic crisis, a crisis in the fundamentals of the economy, I think what we've been arguing, just to be clear for folks, is that Liz Warren does not have the sort of bottom up, this kind of class struggle from below perspective that would even be close to necessary to, as I mentioned, you know, the necessity in the 1970s to go all the way, to go beyond these kind of, piecemeal fixes, which you're arguing, it seems, it would fundamentally bruise, if not mortally wound the left for perhaps a generation.
Her policies are not redistributive enough to fix the fundamental imbalance. And she doesn't have the imagination to, after having watched and been alive for the last 40 or 50 years, she doesn't see this imbalance after how many major large-scale recessions and shocks we've had, savings and loans crisis, the stock market bubble of the early 2000s, the housing crisis, the European debt crisis, the emerging market crisis, the commodities bubble. If all of this stuff hasn't given her a vision that is bigger and more interesting than the one that she has expressed, then I don't see her getting that. I don't see someone who's, I think, 73 years old, who's lived through the last half century and doesn't see a major structural problem, developing a more sophisticated view.
If something that I find sort of like, to build upon that, there's something kind of preposterous in, you know, the insistence that like somebody's life experience or life story is sufficient to make them an authority on certain matters when it comes to sort of liberal identitarianism, right? But then if we, as Marxists, were to point to Liz Warren's very specific set of life experiences, her life trajectory, and sort of cite that as being perhaps indicative of sort of what she believes, but also the events that have shaped those beliefs, we're told that's not playing fair. That's below the belt, right? To say that this was a working class woman who, you know, became pregnant at a very young age and really did, like, she worked her fucking ass off, right? I don't want to downplay that for a moment. She worked her butt off. She was incredibly intelligent, incredibly hardworking. But I'm just going to bite the bullet. I think that her experience of working her ass off and the meritocracy being functional for her is one that has, whilst she hasn't gone full Republican and said, like, you know, just pull yourself up by your bootstraps, anyone can do it, right? She's sort of recognizing that enough has changed that a version of her today would not be able to be her today. What she's completely oblivious to is the idea that for every one of her that came up in her era, there's another 1,000 of her who worked just as hard and didn't make it and can never make it. Because within a capitalist order, we require class hierarchy. And so setting up sort of, you know, these narrow avenues of class mobility for people who work hard enough, making those avenues a little bit wider, is a total concession to the injustice that this system depends on. And to my mind, if you say I'm capitalist to my bones, what you are saying is that there are some people who don't work hard enough or are not smart enough and not special enough and are not meritorious enough, right, to live a kind of decent upper middle class life. And what Bernie says and has been saying for the past 50 years that he's been, you know, had a public presence, for that entire 50 years, and this is my fundamental belief, and I believe it's Adam and Benjamin, yours as well, I believe that if you are a dumb, lazy motherfucker, I want you to have a decent, dignified life, yeah. Right?
You should have health care. You should be able to do
You should have whatever, you a know, the basic, decent have the basic fucking life, even if you're a lazy asshole. Like, and...
I don't believe that people will be lazy assholes.
If no, of they course have not. But
the
I just,
weight of their no, I know. I'm not arguing with you. I just say I think going even further. I think Bernie has like a profound humanist kind of approach as well. Is that I don't believe that people will be lazy assholes if they're given the opportunity to do what they're really passionate about, as opposed to what the market says they must do in order to, you know, subsist in this neoliberal hell world.
Right, but that's the difference between believing in economic rights and not believing in economic rights. If you believe that we ought to have economic rights, then even if you don't use your rights particularly well, even if you're reckless with your economic rights, you still ought to have them. And that's what is so valuable about saying that we ought to have universal access to healthcare, universal access to education, $15 minimum wage. These kinds of things are about setting fixed minimums that don't depend on whether you're a good person.
I mean, I'm almost, and I don't mean to be a pedant, but like, I think there's sort of an easy grift happening with certain atomized policy propositions that because America at present is so far right in just the political milieu that exists at present, because the material conditions are so bad for the majority of people, there are certain policy prescriptions that not only sound similar, but actually are the same, right? There is a whole lot of stuff on our agenda as democratic socialists that is ostensibly social democratic or even just liberal, right? But I think there's a really dangerous conflation that can happen when you say something like, you know, a $15 minimum wage. That, like, the campaign for a $15 minimum wage started something like 12 years ago. And so I think sort of committing to atomized policies, which is at best what Liz Warren does, and I, you know, as I said earlier, I don't even think she does that, but let's say she does that. I don't know. I think we need to be really conscientious about substituting the part for the whole.
A policy is not the same as an attitude to a set of institutions.
Yes,
we
exactly.
We can't judge institutional proposals by policy proposals.
Yes.
And the thing about institutional proposals is that they are not the kind of thing that you can stick on your website in very straightforward terms. I think the closest we come to a straightforward difference in policy, which speaks to different institutional intentions, is Bernie Sanders' support for breaking up the banks. That policy of breaking up the banks is about weakening the financial sector, not regulating it better or policing it, but weakening it and making it smaller as a percentage of the economy, which is something that almost no one else believes in, because almost no one else in American politics wants a smaller financial sector, because they think that the financial sector is a major engine of growth in the economy. Only Bernie Sanders thinks that a smaller financial sector is a good in and of itself. And that's because he has a fundamentally different institutional approach exactly. from all these other candidates.
Yes. Which is why it grinds my gears so badly when people look at something like, for example, this totally atomized and micro proposal of Warren's to potentially manufacture certain drugs if and when the patents have run out and no company is making them, and you know there's no generic company is interested in pursuing that segment of the market, then you know she's contemplating having the government potentially manufacture them. The government at present does manufacture certain generic drugs as part of the like VA, what the VA does, like super broadly speaking. But that, like, what she's literally saying is, if there is a hole in capitalism, like a giant, like a gaping hole, I'll put a Band-Aid over it. But because, you know, you can use certain sorts of terminology that have been alienated completely away from a substantive socialist or Marxist analysis, you can use terms like, well, look, that's like, you know, the means of production. And they've totally taken profit out of the question. This is a socialist policy. And it's just like, well, that's not how this works. You're assessing a policy in fundamentally liberal terms, right? This atomized notion. And, you know, you've extracted terminology from its conceptual context. Yes, sure. That does mean that the government is, you know, has the means of production in some kind of like, in some sense. But to call this a socialist policy is, I think, deeply mistaken. But to people who aren't sufficiently familiar or don't share that worldview, it seems persuasive. It seems really radical, as Adam was alluding to earlier.
Let's make some distinctions here about what we mean. Now, first of all, we're presuming, I think, and quite we're sort of doing a thought experiment, but I think we're presuming, we're just pretending, acting as though, as if her maximal program were implemented. But we also want to acknowledge how much of a leap that is, and for a couple of reasons. Number one, because we've already mentioned that the very means by which she would desperately need for this program to be implemented, even in piecemeal fashion, she would require a mass struggle from below, which would be class-oriented and this kind of inside-outside militant democratic socialist approach. And, you know, her movement, her politics, her ideology, her ethos doesn't even have a whiff of that kind of approach to
No, and Barack Obama's maximal policy agenda was not implemented when the Democrats had a supermajority in both houses of Congress. And there's no reason to think that Elizabeth Warren is as charismatic or more charismatic than Barack Obama, or more able to deliver seats to Democrats with strong left-wing or
It's quite likely they'll retain the House in 2020, but I think it's quite unlikely they'll win the Senate. And even if they did, there's going to be a tremendous amount of pushback without the class struggle from below.
And there will be piles of yellow dog, blue dog Democrats who are not going to vote for these policies. And there's no effort in the Democratic Party to primary challenge these people and remove them. No concerted effort coming from Elizabeth Warren. The only people who are trying to do that are the Bernie Sanders people.
Yeah, I think that's also this kind of fascinating double-edged sword with, and I know that sometimes the term rad lib is thrown around a little too liberally. See what I did there? Anyway, I think there is kind of this curious double bind with it, insofar as Liz Warren, I think, you know, for the reasons that we've outlined thus far and for myriad others, is fundamentally just sort of like a liberal, right? she's fairly centrist. I don't think there's anything significantly left about her politics whatsoever. But to much of the center, and certainly to the right, she's perceived as radically left-wing. So what ends up happening is, at the absolute best, she manages to grab ass. Like, if she really nails it, she'll get some portion of the sort of left, center-left, and some portion of the center. The right will pillory her as a completely radical wing nut, right? And even, as you suggested, significant portions of the Democratic centrists will perceive her as radical, despite her not being, and won't support her. Which means that the actual landscape of support for her is incredibly fucking tiny. Which means, again, that she's sort of the worst of both worlds as opposed to the best of both worlds. You look at someone like Bernie Sanders, and not just in terms of rhetoric, but just, you know, there is something kind of an affect about him that is appealing, including even to significant portions of the right, because he speaks to people and he appeals in a way that Warren doesn't. And I think we can't deny that if we want to win. You know?
Let's put a pin in this. Let's put a pin in it. Again, we could talk about this all night. It would be a really important discussion, I think. But let's put a pin in this. And I think I want to get the two of your take on this. And I think, like, coming back to the bread and butter of what DPS is all about, I think the Democratic Socialist Project requires non-reformist reforms. And what do we mean by that? You know, how do we judge that? That's always a contested claim, right? Is this a non-reformist reform? In what way is it? Is it not? What does that mean? How do we envision this? And I think the bare minimum of what must be present for it to be something to be considered a non-reformist reform is that it's the movement, stupid. Like, if we needed to make a bumper sticker, right? What is a non-reformist reform? It's the movement, stupid. Like, not the economy.
No,
right?
It's the political economy. It's the political economy, stupid.
Yeah, but it's the movement of, well, it has to be political economic or else it's just a fucking joke. I mean, am I right? We're socialists, for God's sake. You're not wrong.
But I don't think Warren has a good handle on political economy. I think she's an economist.
No, she doesn't at all. But I think let me finish. That's a separate criticism. It's an important one, but it's separate slightly from what I'm getting at. Is that non-reformist reform, it's the process by which you build a movement so that and the capacities of the class inside and outside the state so that you ultimately end up winning that reform. That is the important thing. That's not to say that Medicare for all is just a means to an end and forget about the actual, you know, benefits of such a policy. Like, absolutely, we all need it or else you'll die without it. But it also
shifts the boundaries of what is a normal kind of economic right that everybody should be entitled to, expands that category in people's thoughts. It shifts the way we think about what people ought to be entitled to in a society, and that creates new possibilities for new kinds of policies, new kinds of radical policies that if we mention them today would seem ludicrous.
It shifts the expectations. But again, that's almost step two. Step one is that we need to have a robust class-oriented struggle from below in order to achieve any of this. Because you're talking about taking political and economic power away from tremendously powerful corporate and state entities, and they're not going to go down without a fight. I think that really sums up. Any parting words on this? Because we're going to switch to the Beto
conversation. One more thought on this.
Yeah,
I think that one of the things that we've noticed here is if we drew an accurate line and said, who are the people who are interested in fundamental institutional change and who aren't, we would say that Bernie Sanders is, and no one else who has declared or seems interested in declaring is. And so we would say, okay, well, the left of the party is Bernie Sanders, and then the centrists should be divided up among those candidates. Now, that would clearly be a losing proposal for the center, because in that case, the entire left of the party would be behind Sanders, and he would have his 40 or 45% like he had last time. And they would be split among five or six or seven different people. So the only way that they can win is by convincing people that some of these centrists are actually part of the left wing of the party by the use of misleading language and misleading policy proposals and pretending to support things that they don't really support and aren't going to be able to do. And that's why there are loads of different candidates who are now being talked about and positioned as alternative left-wing candidates or alternative progressive candidates to Bernie Sanders. And that's all about creating a split in the left vote so that the center vote doesn't have to deal with the united 40 or 45% behind Bernie Sanders. We've gotten that 40, 45% behind him before, and there's no reason we shouldn't be able to do that again unless people believe and are led to believe that these other people are actually part of a bloc that they're not part of.
I agree with all of that. And just to build on it, I think something that I want to clarify, when we talk about potential candidates, I think there's a really sneaky tendency to, as Benjamin was saying, to imply that there is some kind of like reasonable discussion or actual competition between potential left candidates. There isn't. Bernie is the left, the rest is centrist. Yeah. But what happens in effect, like our perceptions and the political possibilities co-evolve. And if enough noise and distraction can be made so as to not mobilize enough people in a completely unambiguous fashion behind Bernie, well, that's enough for him not to win. So a huge aspect of why he was unable to defeat Hillary the first time was he got in the race a little bit too late. He wasn't really running to win when he first got in. And that changes what you're able to achieve. If we sort of look at the trajectory, had we just moved what he, like, had we just lifted, like, the trajectory of people's enthusiasm and support for Bernie and just moved it back 6 months, he would have hands down been the nominee, right?
Yeah.
So that moment for us, if they can create enough noise to sort of make it as though it's ambiguous, well, then we're not mobilizing the mass movement, or even if not movement, just mass voter support behind Bernie that would be required for him to win. And so it's not like, I think there's this tendency right now to sort of look at this as if it's some speculative potential future thing. No, like, we need to get behind him now. Like, that ambiguity and that implying that there is some potential other candidate, that's actually detrimental, right?
And functionally, Elizabeth Warren isn't there to win. She is just there to take support. Anyone who's looked at the figures knows from her favorability numbers that she is not the most competitive candidate, that she will not win. She is there to create this argument, to create this conversation, and to siphon energy, to siphon people, to siphon money away from a Sanders campaign.
To make enough noise. She's making enough noise to diffuse the signal.
You're right, but let's look around us for a moment. I think this is where I really want to kind of jump in here. And I don't know if any of the patrons, I mean, at least, you know, for now, this is a B-side. I haven't decided if we're going to release this to the general public. It might be too incendiary, or maybe it's exactly what people need to hear. We'll see. But anyway, the patrons are going to hear this first, and it's unclear as to whether or not, you know, we have any our audience right now who are still kind of strongly in favor of a Warren candidacy. But one thing is clear. You go online on the social media spaces in the discourse, and you see an astonishing number of people on the left, journalist types, left pundits, who have earned a tremendous amount of social capital through the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016 and the kind of left-wing Twitter DSA phenomenon, wherein a number of people at some progressive liberal rags like The Nation, The New Republic in these times, people who have their bylines, you know, listed in their Twitter bios, right? These types of people who use their participation in various political movements as social capital on the left. Right. And these people are taking a Warren candidacy very seriously. In many instances, as we mentioned earlier in the show, they are proclaiming against all odds and logic and rationale and history that she is the legitimate heir to the progressive nomination, you know, or over Sanders. Why? Just explain this to me. Why is this happening? I mean, I feel like I wake up and I feel like I'm in hell every day.
The progressives are hell bent. They're just anti-Clinton voters. Anti-Clinton voters. They were never substantively committed to anything he was for. Just anti-Clinton voters.
So what was it in 2016 that had them going so hard for Bernie? Was it because it was just kind of the hip thing to do? But having a rose emoji, you know, beside your Twitter handle was all the rage? Because, I mean, here's the conundrum. I tweeted about this earlier today, and you know, I don't like to often talk about my tweets, but I was just utterly exasperated. On the one end, you have these progressives who are pretending like Warren is a legitimate left-wing candidate, the kind of thought leaders in the discourse. On the other hand, you have these socialists who are holier than thou when it comes to Bernie Sanders, and some of these are friends of mine. But they were hardcore Bernie bros in 2016. But in the last 2 years, they've determined that he is not socialist enough. He's not a true socialist, and they're not going to campaign or push for his nomination, at least not at this stage of the game. And so which leaves us with what option? I mean, at this point, you know, it's possible that Bernie Sanders might not see enough interest in a campaign such that he doesn't even put his name in the ring. Maybe he backs Warren because he just feels like, you know, that's where the energy is. I mean, I don't know. I mean,
polls much higher than she does. I can't see him doing that. And he's sent out emails in the last few weeks that strongly indicate that he's likely to run.
I don't think he's going to do that. Pessimistic. But, I mean, but I know this thing can shift very, very quickly.
We do have a chunk of people who got inspired to be left-wing by Bernie Sanders, and then in the intervening years decided now they're too left-wing for him and won't do anything and won't get involved in electoral politics, and they just want to hang out in their little fan clubs and waste everybody's time. Those people are a problem, and they know they're a problem. The other people that are a problem are the people who really just want Barack Obama back, the people who really like Barack Obama, and if you know, it's most people, huh? In the Democratic Party or around the Democratic Party. They really like Barack Obama, and they just supported Sanders because there was no Obama-type alternative to Hillary Clinton. And that group of people, the group of people that can be fooled by the charismatic, slightly to the left of Clinton figure, is still a major problem for our party. They have, and for our country. They haven't learned anything from the 8 years of Barack Obama's futility. They still really like him. They still really respect him. Every time he gets interviewed, every time he's on the news, they get giddy for him. And those guys are really in danger of submarining us.
And I think if I could try to, I want to sort of play good cop here for a moment. Two things. I think most people, especially working in middle class people, if they're not, you know, hugely revanchist, what they want is a politics that will generally like make their lives materially better. And in the absence of necessarily that, what they want is to just sort of feel a little bit like the person behind the wheel isn't drunk and high and, you know, driving like a Formula One driver in a beat up old truck.
Pussy. Yeah.
Exactly, right? So, like, in the absence of a substantively, like, materially focused candidate, there is a real, we shouldn't completely write off the notion that having someone like an Obama who is, you know, decent enough at not careening the car completely off the road, that sort of, he doesn't exacerbate the, you know, dripping everyday anxiety of a really precarious, you know, life. He doesn't exacerbate that. He's doing nothing to make it better, and the trajectory of neoliberal capitalism is such that, like, it gets worse. That's how this thing works, right? It's a ratchet. So
well, now that the Democrats have the Senate, it's going to be basically like Obama's president again, except instead of hearing the president say things that you like, you'll hear the president say things that you don't like. Exactly. All of the compromises between the Congress and the president are going to be basically the same kinds of compromises they were over the last 6 years. It's not going to be very different, but it's going to sound different and feel different because of who the president is.
And save for a few outliers, the tax bill obviously being a major one, the primary impact that Trump has had for the past couple of years has just been discursive. It's been a reality show. It's been experiential. Like, the experience of having him as president is different. It feels different. But it's sort of too soon for any of the policy decisions and things he's put into play to have had the effect that they're going to have on people's consciousness and or everyday existence, right?
And there were things that Barack Obama proposed and almost did that were well to the right of very much of what Trump has done or proposed. Obama
At one point the grand
talked
bargain.
About cutting entitlements by hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yeah, he was going to completely sacrifice his Social Security, like behind the table.
Barack Obama demolished Libya, completely demolished Libya. There are things
our problem, but we don't feel
what he did at the border, the level of incarceration that goes on at the border dramatically increased under Obama.
Yeah, but he's not the bad man.
Deportations dramatically increased.
It's not the bad man.
So it's all a kind of illusion here. And the sad thing is that, you know, we can't expect people to see through all of this stuff because people don't have time to read up on all of it or to think about all of it. And it's not reasonable to expect them to do so. But that means that it's our job as people who are sympathetic to the left to go out there and make this case to people in as many places, in as many fora, on as many different kinds of websites and social media as we can. And that means we've got to be out for Bernie Sanders and out against, and we must attack and viciously attack all of these other people who claim the mantle of being left-wing or progressive without actually deserving it.
That's right. Yeah. I think one of the things, and I mentioned this, I wrote about this a couple of days ago, is that, you know, there's no question that the discourse leading up to 2020 is going to be god-awful. And people are going to ratchet up all sorts of phony controversies. We're now seeing a quote breaking story wherein some of the campaign staffers, I'm thinking like very low level, perhaps even, you know, campus oriented intern type staffers are saying that the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016 didn't take misogyny and sexism seriously. And then when this was brought to, you know, Sanders' attention, it wasn't given the proper attention. I think, you know, two words I think should probably derail that very quickly. If, like I said, the progressives and the socialists in the media sphere who are leaders in the discourse, who can combat this kind of thing, were principled and were actually in favor of a Bernie Sanders candidacy, which for all sorts of fucked up reasons that we've already talked about, they are not. But if they were, they would just say two words and would shut it down immediately. Jeffrey Epstein. Okay? Jeff Epstein, the billionaire pedophile who used to take, you know, Bill Clinton on joyrides on the reg in his private jet, you know, should shut that down very, very quickly. There is bad behavior on every campaign, and there are people acting in all sorts of ways at elite levels. And it's not even necessarily clear that Bernie engaged in any kind of bad behavior. This is clearly a hit piece, and the shills for Hillary, such as Joan Walsh, are just absolutely giddy about this. Amy, you seem exasperated. Lay it on me.
Yes, because anyone playing fucking DPS bingo, you've got one right now. Fucking me too. It's a political weapon, and I want to even reject Adam. Like, I understand what you're saying about Epstein, and also my immediate response is like to attack as opposed to necessarily defend. Like, but I think on the one hand, the attack is also the fact that Hillary's campaign, in and of itself, contained sexual harassers. The woman who was harassed was laterally moved and the harasser was kept on Hillary's staff throughout the entire period to provide motivational fucking prayers in the mornings, right? not something that's even, if it exists, unique to Sanders. But I think there's a mistake there in that it cedes too much territory. The thing is, this is an attack, and even if you read it and you take it completely seriously on its own terms, there's no there there. It said that matters were dealt with by Bernie at the time. And essentially what these people are haranguing for is a meeting that can be a public spectacle where they berate him. I read the letter and it said
they want a struggle session
and
to
in
build
doing
some social
so,
capital
what
so that, they can
yeah,
get a better
yeah,
campaign
what
job
they're
next
asking
November.
For is to put him in his motherfucking place. And, you know, for whatever reasons they have, maybe they're personal, maybe they're political, maybe they're career reasons. But to imply that there is a there, when even the letter taken at face value contains nothing. It actually contains nothing. There's no accusations about Bernie's campaign ignoring claims of assault or harassment. There's no accusations of anyone having committed any harassment or assault. It is literally, it's using this current context where accusations that are even, you know, vaguely in the vicinity of sexual assault are being treated with a certain kind of deference as an attempt to bend the stick back in favor of a certain type of justice that was perhaps unavailable to certain women for extended periods of time. But let's just remember that epistemic justice of like being believed or not being believed or whatever was, you know, that empathy was always selective, both before, during, and potentially after Me Too. That was a selective deployment of empathy, if a story has content. But this story has no content. There's nothing there. Yeah.
But in any case, I think you're absolutely right about that. I mean, I just think, you know, we can attack that on multiple levels. I think your attack is by far the one that I prefer. And if I had it my way, that's the tact that I would take. But I think at bare minimum, the one that you could take wherein you have the least to lose, potentially in the face of these disingenuous maniacs who occupy the neoliberal wing of the Democratic Party. Such as the Joy Reids and the Joan Walshes and some of the other sort of rad libs that occupy, you know, pseudo left wing spaces as well. You know, the least you just have to say is, come on, this is just pure hypocrisy. I mean, you know, the Clinton campaign's slights or whatever crimes are just legion at this point, and so it can only ever be cynical. But anyway, my point being is that, I mean, you're seeing the shitstorm begin, and the people who are well-placed, the people who have developed social capital in the wake of the 2016 Bernie campaign and have continued it. And I think, you know, Ben, you mentioned it off air that they've all developed a kind of Trump derangement syndrome since then, which has perhaps led to their unwillingness to go to bat for Sanders right now. Talk to us a little bit more about that before we close here.
Well, we have a lot of people right now who have convinced themselves that Donald Trump is the worst thing that has ever happened or ever could happen, and that therefore you have to find the most electable person and put them in immediately and screw everything else. And never mind all the political projects that we've been trying to get done. Never mind the structural situation, never mind major institutional change. The only thing that needs to happen is the removal of the bad individual. And this is a very agent-centric kind of discourse, and it revolves around attributing to one specific individual, Donald Trump, everything bad about the country, everything bad that was happening in many cases before he showed up. And this is not constructive. We've essentially got a bunch of Bernie people who have turned into people who were for Hillary because they thought she could win. And people who are now a little bit older and are maybe looking for a job. And they're using the level of hostility to Trump as a platform for that. It's a sad situation. And I'm reminded of the people who took the microphone from Bernie Sanders in 2015, who were, if I recall, Sarah Palin supporters, Tea Party activists, but masqueraded as left wing for the purposes of commandeering that rally. And the way that these people pretend to be left wing so that they can drag the discussion to the right.
Yeah, yeah. And what, I mean, I'm actually not sure exactly which rally you're referring to, but I think what the thing that I remember seeing above and beyond all things is that this comes down to, you know, ridiculous and false and phony claims to various forms of political representation that people in our show have made very persuasively and continually over the course of the existence of DPS. And, you know, obviously Adolf Reed is prime among them, and Cedric Johnson makes the most, I think, direct case that, you know, race and identity does not constitute a political constituency, and therefore people claiming the mantle of representation when it comes to a certain identity are necessary. Necessarily, in the words of Adolf Reed, race hustlers or identity hustlers. And the hustle isn't trying to put race front and center, because sure, there's no reason why we shouldn't talk about racism. I'm perfectly fine talking about racism. That's not where the hustle lies, you know, contrary to the claims of our critics. The hustle lies insofar as they know where they have to go to get their bread buttered, right? You take the microphone from Bernie Sanders in 2019, and you've got yourself a career, baby.
And you see that in the Salazar piece for New Republic. If you're producing work for a constituency, or you're being paid by a particular kind of person or firm, that impacts and influences what you do.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no question. There's no question. We're going to have to take this to a part two. Is everybody okay with that? We can give the patrons a part two. Later next week. Next week, we'll give the patrons a part two, because you just alluded, Ben, yourself to your, I think, most expansive piece, if you will, about Miguel Salazar's really disingenuous piece. I think it's been called journalistic malpractice, and I co-sign that label against a certain faction of the DSA that we ourselves find ourselves, we're quite partisan of, and we want to talk a lot about that article. We want to give it its full due. Do you guys feel good about giving the patrons a part two, a part due?
Yeah, I'm up for that.
Of course, of course. I think it wouldn't do it justice to try to cram in, in the last few moments here.
Yeah. All right. Barkeep, keep our tab open, and we'll be back for a part two. Anybody want to put a pen in this discussion?
Yeah, I have another thought that I just want to finish with, and it's I was reading a particular speech made by I think Peter Camejo back in 1970, and it's entitled "Liberalism, Ultra-Leftism, or Mass Action." And I think a lot of this sort of slipperiness that we've seen starting to become apparent in recent months, between these sort of actors who seemed back in 2016 to be very much on, on a Bernie-oriented, political line. So it just sort of speaks to, I think, that the actual cracks in what seemed like a coherent set of actors a couple of years ago. So sometimes the liberal becomes frustrated not getting the ear of the ruling class, and he concludes that he's been using the wrong tactics. So he adopts a lot of radical rhetoric. These liberal ultra-leftists thinks that tantrums are what moves the ruling class. And then came the instant fascism theory. We're about to have fascism any moment now. But this is a very confusing theory. Somehow the rallies and demonstrations continue year after year. They don't put us in the concentration camps. This theory is actually a mixture of deep cynicism, thinking that the ruling class is all powerful, but it always is combined with a last hope that maybe they aren't completely bad. Maybe there's still someone who'll listen. And this, so then he sort of extends on and sort of talks about these incredibly radical sounding proposals, but they're the kind of proposals that have no teeth, much like many of the ones that we would sort of criticize, like radical sounding, hashtag abolish ICE, open borders. So you sort of combine these superficially radical sounding policies with this ongoing insistence that fascism is just around the corner. And then he says, this is a key thing to understand about the ultra-leftists. The actions they propose are not aimed at the American people. They're aimed at those who have already radicalized. They know beforehand that masses of people won't respond to the tactics they propose. They've not only given up on the masses, but really have contempt for them. Because on top of all this, do you know what else the ultra-lefts propose? They call for a general strike. They get up and say, general strike. Only they don't have the slightest hope whatsoever that it will come off. And then sort of this is a little bit further on. If you don't understand the relationships which exist in this society, because they're not apparent at first sight, you can make some tragic errors. The working class and the oppressed nationalities are mass social layers, and they can only realize their potential power when they organize as a massive social force. The ruling class can deal with any one individual or any small group. It's only masses that can stand in their way.
Right.
And I just think that really speaks to these sort of like aesthetically radical ideas that fundamentally, when you look under the surface, there's no there there. And the reason there's no there there is because these people are not committed to any kind of substantive or thick notion of democracy and mass politics. They're committed to their own personal projects. And when you look at the institutions in which they work and operate, that makes perfect sense. It's in their material interest to be doing exactly what they're doing, carving out a particular niche brand or ideological identity for themselves that will allow them to continue to function in the socioeconomic world in which they operate, which is fundamentally an elitist bubble. And I think we really need to sort of make, like, not confuse ourselves into thinking that because we have access to somebody on Twitter, that their political orientation or even just their material interests are the same as ours. They're not. And it's not cynical to point out who somebody works for and who signs their paychecks. Like, that's a pretty basic thing that needs to be sort of kept in mind when we're assessing their behavior in ways that would seem contradictory. It actually makes perfect sense when you look at where their bread is buttered.
An aesthetic commitment to radicalism is not the same as a substantive political or even moral commitment. Exactly. An aesthetic commitment to radicalism is just what kind of t-shirt you wear.
A Che Guevara one, baby.
Right. Yeah, we've seen a lot of that, unfortunately. We have seen a lot of that. We've seen a lot of Bernie Bros, and I say that with love, tongue in cheek. That's not a thing, by the way. It's not a fucking thing, but whatever.
Turning into hoes.
We've seen a lot of
is what you're saying.
Bernie Bros, yeah.
Become hoes.
Or that. you said it, not me. Give in to this kind of pseudo ultra leftism, and so I love that passage by Peter Camejo to bring us back to earth. So we're gonna put a pin in it there. Patrons, thanks so much for listening and bearing with us. This has been another long B side, but you got your money's worth. We had a lot to say, and there's going to be a lot more coming in part two. We're going to break down the arguments in Ben's really important piece, his intervention in the New Republic piece by Miguel Salazar, wherein Miguel claims that on the one side you have people who care about racism, and I don't know, on the other side you have a bunch of white racists in the DSA. It's an absolutely abysmal, appalling, really deceptive treatment, and I could say way more about that, but unfortunately we'll have to save that for next week.
He's just asking questions, Adam.
He's just
Does DSA have a race problem? just asking
That's
questions.
That's a neutral, not clickbaity at all. Anyway.
I'm not jacking off. at all.
Yeah, right. Not at all. Well, fortunately for us, Benjamin Studebaker was just asking questions as well, and so we're going to talk about his piece on next week's B-side. All right. Thanks again, Ben, for joining us, everybody.
Yeah, thanks, Ben.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
The A-Team will be back next week for the B-side, so everybody stay tuned until then. All right.
Bye.